Okay, so one of the less understood things about an hour-long podcast is that it actually takes quite a few hours behind the scenes to make. You're lining up different people's schedules, you're writing scripts, editing audio, making it feel effortless actually takes a bit of effort. That's why I want to recommend Notion. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired too, so that when it comes time to hit the record button, everyone's on the same page, where TeamSpace or Calendar or QuickNote have a play around, they're all there. Notion combines your collaborations into one space that's simple and clear, and it also has some AI running in the background to help things along. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/squared. And just an FYI, that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting what we do here on the show too. That's notion.com/squared.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. On the podcast today, Thomas Halliday, the paleobiologist and best-selling author who is helping us to better understand how the natural world has evolved over the past 500 million years. We'll try our best to fit it in into about 60 minutes. Thomas Halliday is an associate research fellow at the Department of Earth Sciences of the University of Birmingham. His recent book, Otherlands, A World in the Making, has impressed both academics and curious readers alike, while circling the giddy heights of bestseller lists too. The book guides us through a series of ancient landscapes, from the dawn of complex life 500 million years ago, up to the birth of humanity, using immersive storytelling and sharp scientific analysis to bring that journey to life. Our host for the discussion is the science writer and broadcaster, Gaia Vince. Here's Gaia and Thomas in conversation.
I'm so excited to be talking to Thomas Halliday, who has written a really incredible book. Tell me, first of all, why did you write it? I mean, you're sitting there researching at work. Why did you decide you wanted to write a book?
Oh, well, for this book in particular, one of the things that I sort of find as a mammal paleontologist is that, you know, dinosaurs get all the headlines. And so we sort of sit there thinking, well, there's all of this other amazing part of Earth's history and the history of life that just doesn't really get a look in the, at least in the popular sort of imagination. You know, generally people know about the time of the dinosaurs, which they sort of telescope together into this one homogenous period of time. People know about the Ice Age. Maybe some people have heard about the Cambrian explosion, but there's all sorts of things that happened in the hundreds of millions of years either side of these well-known periods. So that was one aspect. And then another is that I'm a big fan of nature writing, and I quite often sort of like to imagine, I mean, as a paleobiologist, what life was like. And for me, that means imagining what life was like at the level of the landscape, of the ecosystem. And so that's really what the book is trying to do, trying to reconstruct these 16 sites from the last half a billion years of Earth history.
And it's so successful at doing that. It reads like almost like a travel book back through time. You really get transported to these landscapes. It's very, very visual, and it's really hard to describe. So what I would like you to do actually is read. I know it's a bit different for Intelligence Squared to do this, but I'd really love it if you could read a very short passage from one of your chapters where you introduce a Gorgon, which is not the monster with the snake hair, something different.
Yeah, so this is from a chapter which is set in modern day, what would become Niger, but it's 253 million years before the present. The winds have changed. Northerlies blow through a sparse dune field, whipping up ridges and bringing sharp shards of silicate hard and fast through the air. It is difficult to see anything distinctly. Out on the salt flat, there is no respite, no place in which to hide from the deep, red, piercing wind. A female Gorgon tries to lift herself from the ground, shaking away the accumulating sand as she takes another step. To resist this ongoing burial is exhausting, but sandstorms are frequent enough that this will not have been the first she has had to endure. Her thick skin, scarred with age, provides some resistance to it, if not absolute protection. The rainy season is due any day now, heralded by the return of the north wind, but until the sandstorm subsides, there is little to do but wander and wait. Her jaw is swollen, and she is limping. Ever since a flailing blow from a Bunastegos she'd been hunting fractured her leg, it has never been the same. The injury is now healed, blood having flooded the broken area, helping the living tissue to knit together quickly, a handy physiological consequence of an active, hot-blooded lifestyle. But the strengthening of the new bone growth has healed as a lump, holding the fracture together from the outside, though weaker than it once was. For a member of the group Gorgonopsia like this, the apex predator at Dusty Moradi, such injuries are occasionally severe, but not uncommon. The swollen jaw, though, is more unusual. Looseness in her long, sharp left canine might have been the result of a new tooth coming through. Despite having differentiated teeth like mammals, incisors, canines, and post-canines, Gorgons replace their teeth continuously, more like modern reptiles. Gorgons are active predators and need a functioning pair of upper and lower canines in order to feed. To make sure that this happens, they alternate the replacement of their left and right canines and replace both at the same time. However, her right canines are themselves already mid-replacement, so a loose tooth on the left means something else. This is a more pressing development, an accident of cell division. Within her jawbone is an odontoma, a cancerous tumour, pressed up against the root of her canine. The tumour is filled with miniature teeth, and as they develop, they are slowly eroding the nearby root. She shifts her jaw uncomfortably in her lips. The storm will soon be over.
I mean, it's so evocative. I think it feels almost like we're watching a nature documentary and it's being described to us, only, of course, this was hundreds of millions of years ago. And the incredible detail that you describe in your book, obviously, you know, you weren't there videoing it and then describing it. You know, how much of this is guesswork? How much of it is based on new evidence? Tell me about that specific Gorgon passage.
Well, yeah, specifically with that Gorgon. So for Moradi itself, it's this sort of wet desert ecosystem where it's an extremely sort of seasonal period in Earth's history. So you've got Pangaea being this sort of big C-shaped continent, and the land, and then this enormous sort of C-shaped embayment of an ocean, and then land to the south means that you get really strong monsoons. And so in Moradi, it's sort of at the end of flowing of where the water ends up at. So it's a bit like Lake Eyre in Australia today. It's this Playa Lake which dries up and then refills. It doesn't have any exit point. And although we know that the Gorgonopsians were present in Moradi, this passage is inspired by two other fossils that we do have of Gorgonopsians from other parts of the world. So we have a Gorgon which has an odontoma in its jaw, a fossil Gorgon from, I think it's in Tanzania. And it is the
incredible.
And it's the earliest
example. You actually have the remains of a creature that actually suffered, well, toothache.
Yeah, and this is tooth cancer, right? It's you know, a tumor that is developing that is filled with teeth. And I mean, I'm sure people may have sort of seen images of those occurring in humans. And I think this is the earliest occurrence of cancer in the fossil record, right? Cancer just being a genetic condition. It's not something that has evolved over time. It's just what happens when cells divide badly. To the injury to the leg from Abunastegos, which is later explained as being this sort of large cow-sized herbivore, sort of reptilian herbivorous animal. The fractured leg of a Gorgonopsian shows, I think one from South Africa shows evidence that it has re-healed in a way that implies that it had it was warm-blooded like us and sort of had a mammalian physiology. So all through this, everything I say is grounded in something. It might not be from that particular site. It might be inferred from what we know about modern biology and useful analogues in the present day. But there is a source behind everything I say that isn't just something that's more impressionistic, or the emotional side of things is obviously sort of my impression of the fossil record and my sort of personal response to it. But the factual elements are all grounded in research.
I mean, how difficult was it to put yourself into this very, very different world? I mean, we were talking about Pangaea. I mean, that's everything is different. Everything, even the position of the continents, the ocean, the everything, the climate. Mm-hmm. How did you put yourself in? And that's the pattern of the book. You know, there are all these different ecosystems, but these different worlds. Essentially, it's like visiting different planets, which is essentially what you're doing through time.
Right. It's trying to. The worlds of the past are very different, and they have different species living there. We get to points where the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is 10 times that of the modern day. Right. But the ecosystems still follow not laws exactly. Biology as a subject doesn't really have laws in the way same way physics does, but the same sort of patterns emerge over time. And so you'll see rules like the proportion of predators in an ecosystem remains sort of relatively constant at about sort of 10% the level of the number of herbivores and so on. That is that's a rule of energy flow through food chains that sort of is consistent. And so from a biological perspective, it's sort of explaining the ecological rules that persist, even though an individual ecosystem might be completely extinguished. You know, all of the places in this book are gone and will never come back. And we can be sort of sad about that, or we can sort of think, well, we have ecosystems that are around today that are just as wonderful and just as marvelous. It's just that we're used to them because they are the ones that are of our time.
And there is a pathos, there's a poignancy to all of that because yes, you're describing worlds and inhabitants that to them, their world is exactly how we see our world today. It will always be like this. It's always been like this. And we can't imagine our extinction or the extinction of these ecosystems. And yet we are already going through this unprecedented, really rapid change. Mm-hmm. When you look back over such immense timescales as hundreds of millions of years, how do you get your head around that in order to make sense of it for the reader? Because you do make sense of it.
So for the most part, there are two sides to this. How do I get my head around millions of years? And I think partly that's just exposure through, a decade of research. You just sort of, oh, yeah, a million years. That's fine. That's just the units we're working with. It kind of becomes condensed into something. But I mean, when we're talking about change and the rate at which things are happening, in general, even the big mass extinctions happen over a relatively long period of time. I mean, from a human perspective, we're talking about thousands or tens of thousands of years for the end Permian mass extinction, which is the worst of all. We paleontologists know it as the Great Dying, when 95% of life on Earth went extinct. And that was caused by vast volcanic eruptions over an extremely long period in what is now Siberia, which put lava, what we call traps, out over an area that is equivalent to the size of Australia today, right? So that's a very severe event over a very long period of time that ultimately changed the climate such that a lot went extinct, and it was very dramatic. The only time when life has been really wiped out over an extremely short period of time is the end Cretaceous mass extinction, which everyone is kind of familiar with, which is when the a meteorite struck into the shallow seas off what is now the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, and dinosaurs, apart from birds and a whole swathe of other creatures, went extinct.
I think that's skewed our sense of extinctions, yeah, hasn't it? Because everyone's obsessed with dinosaurs, as you said earlier, and that extinction was very sudden. Generally, it has been a lot slower, and that's kind of hard to capture as well in a book.
Yeah, the push and press of just ecological change. I mean, when we get things, so when the Siberian traps erupted, it put a whole lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So in some senses, it's an analog to today, and you get similar patterns, deoxygenation of the ocean, and increases in things like acid rain and changes to the climate, and so a lot of the effects, although they took a long time to get going, are similar. And so we can sort of see how the ecosystems change over time. I mean, right now we are experiencing the biggest increase in carbon dioxide, specifically emission in history, as far as we can tell, in prehistory. Right, the second fastest rise was at a time at the end of an epoch called the Paleocene. So it's a time known as the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, and this is a time when the poles are forested. It's already quite a warm period in Earth's history. And while you don't get huge mass extinction at that time, you get real turnover in species. Ecosystems change. That's when you get the origin of what we might think of as modern faunas, the precursors to the modern fauna. Before then, you're in this weird transition.
I mean, when we think of that time, 55,000 million years ago, when we think of that that period of time, it was very different. It was tropical. You know, there were alligators around our coasts. The tree line, you know, had moved completely differently. Hippos in London. You know, it was a very, very different time. And yet when we look at our carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere now, we don't really see much difference. You know, maybe the olive trees in Britain might have fruit for the first time, but we're not seeing that big change because it takes thousands of years there is this lag. And so we don't get the sense of that big change, which you can show from the past, because it's so much more compressed when we look back. I mean, that's a problem, isn't it?
It is. So one of the things which I think is a really common misconception in communication is when we talk about the error bars of what the temperature change will be by 2100, for example. The error isn't vertical, it's not in the temperature, right? We can really accurately predict from the carbon dioxide level what temperature we'll eventually get to. The error is horizontal. It's at what point do we get that stabilization? And so the curve looks different and then crosses 2100 at a different point. So we are currently predicting if we go through the so-called business as usual approach, which basically means that we don't try to do any kind of carbon dioxide reduction, and we just carry on emitting as we have been, that in 2100 we will have carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere that are the same as in the Eocene, when Antarctica was a rainforest.
I mean, it's pretty horrifying. I will say that this business as usual is very, very unlikely now, because we have made changes.
Yes.
But even with that, you know, we could reach 4 degrees, which is shocking. Mm-hmm. And it's that commitment, isn't it, for the centuries after. We look up to 2100, but there's that commitment to those centuries after, which you see when you look in the past, when it has stabilized, when ecosystems have moved, and you do see that very different world. It's difficult to imagine in a generation that, because it does take a little bit longer.
Yeah, absolutely. All of these things take time, and there will be local effects as well. When people often talk about the permafrost in the Arctic melting, and that, you know, is a risk, but it will happen in some areas more than others. When you get little sort of divots in the landscape that manage to maintain cold just through the cold air sort of sitting in it as a little basin over time, then that will melt less, and so you'll get sort of different local effects here and there. I think sort of we don't want to talk about sort of scary runaway tipping points, because that's
although.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are possibly, a few of those out there. But I think that what's more important is it is acting, recognizing that if something, then it's going to be really severe, but that if we do act, we can change it, and we know what to do, really. We have known actually for quite a long time what to do.
And I think one of the things that's quite interesting is obviously when you're looking back through other lands, you're talking about times long before anything resembling us was around almost entirely, you know, apart from the very beginning. And now there is a species with agency over the climate, agency over biodiversity, over the way that we move water around the atmosphere, or where we put forests and that sort of thing. And it can have that huge effect. I'm wondering, when you're writing this, how at the front of your mind that very different time that we're living in now, this Anthropocene, compared to these sort of natural, if you see what I mean, worlds that the planet experienced before us and will experience after us.
Mm-hmm. So I think that it was very much at the front of my mind. There are chapters which are explicitly about topics that are very relevant to this. So, I mean, I can think of the Oligocene chapter, which is set in a place called Tingirurica in Chile. And this is that's all about the idea of what makes sort of native species and how species move around the world, right? So right now we have ourselves as a species transported all sorts of creatures into places where they wouldn't naturally be, whether that's, you know, deer into New Zealand because we sort of like the idea of sort of all the animals in Shakespeare being there, or whether it's you know, accidental ones like moving in sort of ballast water of ships from one part of the oceans to another, and so on. But in the Oligocene, South America is this sort of interesting island continent which had evolved. It's a very unique set of mammals in particular, but fauna in general. And yet you get this influx of organisms which appear to be coming from Africa, which is the Atlantic is about half the width at that time that it is today, but it's still a substantial barrier. And yet all of the monkeys in South America, all of the rodents in South America are descended from African ancestors that got there across this Atlantic Ocean. And the idea that what we believe is how they got there is that during storms, the sort of banks of big rivers can have fragments that detach and remain pretty stable and coherent, you know, even with sort of trees remaining vertical. And these then get washed out into the ocean. And so these natural vegetation rafts are what is really most likely to have carried quite a lot of organisms across the ocean from, you know, the proto Congo River or whatever was sort of in that position at the time.
Monkey boats, Thomas. You're talking
monkey boats. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, just call it what it is. It's monkeys on boats. Yeah. Monkey boats.
Yeah.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Thomas, you talk a lot about the animals, of course, because, you know, we all love animals from the past, but also about the flora, trees. And one of the most interesting to me always is how is this systemic way that the physical planet created life, and that life created the physical planet, and how they interact, and you get this complexity, this emergent property of the biosphere, which is kind of greater than the sum of just individual plants. And I thought it was really interesting in one of the chapters, I think it might be the same one as the Gorgon, actually, when you're talking about, I think it might be the Devonian, when you're talking about these horsetail plants, which still exist today, and their roots help erode the rocks, and that has an effect on the carbon dioxide level. Talk us through that, because it really underpins to me something which I don't think people appreciate enough, this continual interaction between life and the physics and chemistry of our planet, the geology.
Yeah, roots are absolutely fundamental. So what you're talking about is what we call weathering of the rocks, and specifically of rocks that are high in silicates. And when roots sort of delve into and sort of push apart rocks that are made of silicate, it exposes that to the air. And one of the consequences of this is that it reacts with the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and locks it up as a mineral. And, you know, if you're locking up something as a mineral, as opposed to, say, a living thing, which is going to die and then decompose and release that carbon dioxide again, it retains it within the rock. And so, I mean, there have been some people that have advocated for using plants like bamboo today, which are incredibly fast growing. They're very good at weathering rock when they do grow, as a potential sort of additional solution to climate change, because the mere act of growing them not only produces you provides you with material that you can turn into fabrics and as well as as furniture and all sorts of excellent products that we could use, but also it actually locks in carbon dioxide as a sort of byproduct. And in the Carboniferous period, we had sort of the growth of the first major forests. So there had been plants before on land. There had been a few big trees towards the end of the Devonian, but the Carboniferous is the period where the real sort of plant-dominated world emerges. And this huge sort of explosion in organic life, the mass of organic life, completely changed the atmosphere, and we get this huge sort of reduction in carbon dioxide concentration over the course of the Carboniferous, to the extent that the trees that really facilitated this, which we call scale trees because of their sort of diamond scale pattern bark, they sort of fundamentally changed the atmosphere towards a climate that couldn't really support the ecosystem they had evolved to inhabit. So scale trees would grow in, you know, 2 feet of water in a hot and humid swamp. And when the world sort of got a bit more arid as a result of this sort of general reduction in atmospheric CO2, the swamps sort of dried up, and we get what's known as the Carboniferous rainforest collapse, and we sort of move into this very arid world of the Permian, which is where the Gorgon comes in.
And that's interesting, because of course those swamps, that's that carbon that was stored in those swamps, we now burn ourselves.
Yeah.
That's coal, and that's what we now burn, and we release all of that. So it's this cycle, it's the cyclical nature of the last millions of years, which the increase in CO2, the reduction of CO2, and until recently that was a cycle which wasn't consciously interrupted in the way that we have from the Industrial Revolution. I think it's so fascinating. One of the most moving and extraordinary parts of the book to me. And I've been to Gibraltar, a couple of times for the Neanderthals actually, and every time I'm there, I think about this waterfall. Tell us about this waterfall, because, you know, it's just too incredible to imagine.
Yeah, it's people ask me, you know, if I had a time machine, where would I go? And this is really the answer. You know, forget going back to the time of the dinosaurs or seeing the creatures that I've studied myself. I want the spectacle.
Really dangerous. Sounds very scary.
Oh, I think I think we should tell people what it is first.
Describe this incredible scene.
So Africa is moving northwards. Towards Europe, as it has been for millions of years. And at the end of the epoch, which is known as the Miocene, it had moved north to such an extent that it cut off the Mediterranean Sea from the Atlantic Ocean. And as it happens, the Mediterranean is in a relatively dry part of the world, and the rain that falls on it and the rivers that feed it are outweighed by the rate at which water evaporates from the surface. And so once the Mediterranean had been cut off from the Atlantic, that means that it slowly begins to evaporate and get lower and lower and saltier until we end up with this kilometres deep salt pan, which would have had extraordinary temperatures at the bottom as a result of the sort of pressure-based heating that you get when you descend. And which, you know, today we can see huge, kilometer deep deposits of salt, of halite, salt rock, at the bottom of the Mediterranean. But of course, the Mediterranean's full now, so obviously it refilled at some point. And the way that it refilled
over what time period,
yeah,
Thomas?
It was catastrophic.
Tell us.
over probably about 1 or 2 years. I mean, people argue about exactly how long it took. But it happened in two phases, we know this. So initially you get a strike-slip earthquake. So that's when two plates go sort of parallel to one another. And this sort of jolted the land down around what is now the Straits of Gibraltar and opened the gates for what was sort of a bit like a weir-like sluice of water as the Atlantic poured into the Western Mediterranean. And turned the Balearic Islands back into islands and turned Corsica and Sardinia back into islands. But it came up against this barrier, which is an area of higher ground, or what is now high seabed, that is Italy and Sicily and Malta and the shallow seas in between them. And so after the Western Mediterranean had filled, it then came to the lip of that. And we can see now in the at the bottom of a steep submarine cliff by what is now Syracuse, the remnants of a waterfall that was 1.5 times the height of the Angel Falls and much, much wider than the Niagara Falls. I mean, the biggest waterfall that has ever existed. And that is what I would go to see.
I mean, the spectacle, it must have been absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
Changing a dry salt flat suddenly into a completely different world with the sound alone must have been you know, unbelievable. You must have been able to hear it for miles.
Yeah, absolutely. And the rate at which it's filling, the Eastern Mediterranean's filling at probably a meter a day for the amount of water that's pouring over there. And to just think of the, you know, the entire ocean from essentially from Sicily to the coast of what is now Israel, just rising up a meter every day is just an incredible idea. And for the organisms that lived on
these
islands.
And when was this? When did this happen?
This is about 5 million years ago, at the end of the Miocene, the beginning of the Pliocene. Yeah, the whole episode is known as the Zanclean Flood, which is, I think, one of the sort of great names in paleontology and geology.
And it could well have been witnessed by our last common ancestor with the chimpanzee, hanging out there, watching this incredible sea level rise.
Yeah, a bit of a trek from East Africa, but you know, it's
you don't know where they went on their monkey boats. Maybe maybe they went on holiday in the Med. I mean, looking back in a way is easier to do than looking forward, because we have the evidence. We can look at the striations in the rock, we can look at fossils, the past has already happened. What does it tell us about looking forward? I mean, look 5 million years forward. Can you do that?
You can. There are some ways that you can do that. So we can predict to some extent where continents are moving, because we sort of know their current trajectories and understand the mechanisms that drive that tectonic movement.
So we can tell, like, the Himalayas are still rising and...
Yeah, India will continue to sort of plow up towards there. You've got the Baja California, which is, you know, the San Andreas Fault is a famous fault that where you've got that strike slip movement. It will eventually become an island that is separated. I don't think that'll happen in 5 million years. That seems quite short a timescale for that kind of thing. Yeah, in 5 million years, that the world will not look substantially different, but it partly depends, of course, how sea levels rise. And to some extent, when we're looking forward in time, it entirely depends what we do now, right? So if after, you know, 5 million years is more than twice the length of time that the genus Homo has existed, right? So predicting what the world will be like at a point that is sort of longer than most species tend to last for, I guess we could think about it in terms of a post-human world, although humans are quite good survivors. We're quite sort of a good generalist. It's difficult to see a way that we actually go extinct.
Well, I mean,
sense.
We've only been around for sort of 200,000 years. So are we good survivors? I mean, compare us to a tortoise, or compare us to a tree.
We have a lot of traits that that are very suitable for surviving mass extinction events. The one thing that is probably against us is that we're quite big, and that's usually a bad sign for organisms at mass extinction events, because we need a lot of food and generally take a long time to reproduce. And for humans, that's certainly true. But we are ecological generalists of the finest order, to the extent that we modify the environment to make it within our niche, right? And that will continue to be true through tool use and so on. But, you know, if we're not talking about human extinction, though, when we're thinking about what happens to humans in the future, we should be thinking about actually the suffering of societies, because there's a big difference between, you know, extinction and everything's fine, right? There's a graded middle in which things get increasingly bad, and they already are affecting the least wealthy parts of the world, which have contributed least to the problem, right? We're in a place where countries like the UK that industrialized very early and with carbon-based fuels have caused the issues that are now affecting places like the islands in the South Pacific and Bangladesh. While they have not really contributed much to that problem. So I think we need this sort of level of I'm sort of taking this on a tangent a little bit from your original question, just because
no,
I don't
I
think
mean,
there's
is,
a lot we can
yes,
predict in the
because,
far
because
future.
humans Yeah, humans are a different animal from other animals. We, you know, we have other needs apart from to be able to eat, reproduce, and live long enough for our young. We have a lot of other needs, so we're a bit different. But in terms of humans, I mean, we evolved at a particular time in a particular place. And in a particular environment, well, mainly in the Paleocene, just recently been in the Holocene, and our population's grown very great, and we've changed the world, and our cities and other landscapes have been made really very recently in a few millennia. When you look back on the ecosystems of the past, on the eras and the past eons that we've been through, which of those would be habitable for a time traveling human population now, if it was just to be sort of plopped into a completely different world? Because some of them were too hot for us to survive, or too cold for us to survive, or didn't have enough oxygen in the atmosphere, or constantly burning.
Yeah, we would not want to arrive in the middle of a mass extinction event, I think is fair to say. but those are the sort of punctuating events that... for the most part, the world isn't there. I think probably we don't want to go too far back, because at some point we're going to lose anything that we can eat. So we, as terrestrial animals, are only really going to have an environment on land realistically about as far back as the Carboniferous. Into the Devonian, there'll be fish in the sea, but the diet's going to be pretty same, probably not that healthy for what we're used to. But from the Carboniferous onwards, that's really when the atmosphere begins to resemble our own anyway. So I think any point after that is survivable somewhere in the world. There will be places where we can't survive, but that's true of the world today. If you put people in the middle of the South Pole, then they're not going to survive without really substantial infrastructure.
Yeah. Exactly, because they survive on this human-made world, but that human-made world didn't exist in the past.
Sure. Oh, yes. Okay. So, yes, if you just drop us entirely, naked and afraid, into then we're probably not going to do very well, even those that are, skilled at survival. I guess that... Yeah, it's a difficult
question. So maybe we need to maintain the environment that we're lucky enough to be born into.
Well, absolutely, and that world has it's evolved alongside us. I think people tend to sort of separate the human world and the natural world, whereas we are very much a part of it. But that also goes for we can have very positive impacts on the environments and on diversity. If you look at pre-Columbian management of the Amazon rainforest, right? It's been affected by humans for thousands and thousands of years.
Just discovering so much more every year. It's so exciting that it's bizarre that we go from a position of this was all wilderness and had nothing to do with humans, rather than assuming everywhere we went was interfered with by humans, because that's the evidence from today.
And the issue then is really actually how do we interfere? Because most of the problems that we are developing come from this kind of short-termist interference, where we just try and extract something right now and not really think about what's going to happen in 100 years, in 200 years or more.
So we need to look into the far future. Thomas, it's such a pleasure talking to you. I could talk for ages, but I can't keep you away from your audience, who also have questions. And goodness me, I must say that the Intelligence Squared audience are not shy. Question one is, do we know when sex happened for the first time?
Oh, that's a good question. So the first evidence of sex we have is, from the Ediacara Hills, which is actually one of the chapters in the book, conveniently, where we get this...
The pornographic chapter.
Where we... There are creatures like it's called Phoenicia Dorothea, which literally means Dorothy's rope, and it's a sort of rope-shaped organism that grew anchored by one end to the sediment in these groups. And so it's thought that they would have released their sperm and eggs, their gametes, at the same time, and so fertilize, and then these drift off and settle somewhere and form this new group, which is, and the evidence for this is really based on the clustering of these organisms, which you don't expect if you get the sort of asexual branching that a lot of the other organisms at that time show. So whether that's the first example of sex that happened is, I'm not certain. I think it's one of the first ones where we have pretty sort of solid evidence sort of based on the demographic changes. But by the time we get back that far, everything's pretty soft bodied. So it's really hard to find sites where they're well preserved. And we get increasingly sort of distant from the organisms we're familiar with. So identifying these very cellular processes, very soft processes, it gets very, very difficult. I mean, with some sites, of course, do preserve soft tissues extremely well, and we call these sort of Lagerstätte, these sites of exceptional preservation, and several of those are the sort of inspiration for these chapters. And even some, like the Soon Shale in South Africa, where the normal rules are completely inverted and you get muscle fiber level preservation of soft tissue, and then just the hard tissue is completely dissolved. And it's just it's an odd consequence of the local chemistry and really acidic bottom waters that dissolve these calcium carbonate shells. And yet the way that the mud is formed, it's like it turns the sort of flesh into a clay that is just very well preserved, this elite. It subverts all of the sort of expectations that you have. You know, as I say, in biology, you have a law and then something will just break it. You know, we don't have those same sort of physics rules. There's always something out there.
Well, here's a really interesting question, because this gets to the heart, I guess, of how evolution changed the landscape. Well, the seascape initially, I suppose. Could you talk a little bit more about how animals grew eyes and how those eyes changed how these animals interacted?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first eyes that we really have evidence for come about several times independently in the Cambrian. So just after what has historically been known as the Cambrian explosion. There's more and more evidence coming about that the Cambrian explosion is not really a huge sort of sudden radiation. It's more an explosion in preservation, right? And so you get this, the origin of all sorts of interesting new features. Eyes are one, and this hard outer exoskeletons are another. So we're getting creatures that are armored. And what I think is the case, and what has been borne out by a few recent papers, is that this is really when predators start get going. We have the first evidence of food webs that look like the food webs of today, based on sort of demographic analyses of these sites of exceptional preservation, where we've got really good idea of relative population sizes and so on throughout a community.
Because over these millions and millions of years, although ecosystems have changed and animals and plants have changed, at the heart, the struggle for survival remains quite similar.
Yeah, and you get these sort of almost sort of coded rules, like yellow and black is dangerous, right? That's something which seems to have been extremely long-lived, and we have some preserved coloration of wasps from the Cretaceous which show this same yellow and black coloration. The same sort of the same sight that makes you suddenly recoil at a picnic is something that would have made a small dinosaur think twice.